Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, a.k.a. Roger Ebert and Me, a Siskel and Ebert tribute podcast in which we review every movie every Friday. Every movie. Every Friday, we talk about every movie ever made. No, every Friday, we talk about every movie coming out that day. Because Friday, as we all know, is the universal day of new movie releases in the world. And this week, we have 9 new releases, but we're covering 10 movies on the podcast because we have a very special early edition review of the PlayStation film Gran Turismo. Not to be confused with Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino. And spoiler alert, no, Clint Eastwood does not sing "In My Gran Turismo" over the end credits of Gran Turismo, much to the audience's chagrin. But we are here to cover that movie, which is not coming out until August 25th, I believe, is the release date. And it's getting 2 weekends of sneak previews. So you can actually see Gran Turismo this weekend, and you can see Gran Turismo next weekend, but it's not out, okay? That movie is not out. It is a sneak preview, and it comes out on the 25th. But there are 9 other movies out this week, including the second Dracula movie of the year from Universal, really using their Universal monster lineup. No, they're not. They're just using that one over and over again for some reason. But we're talking about that. We're talking about a handful of the rest of them are all independent movies you may not have heard of that I think are all worth talking about, except for one big one that is a Netflix actioner, Mission Impossible wannabe called Heart of Stone with Gal Gadot or Gal Gadot? Mark,
it's Gadot. It is Gadot.
Confirmation. Gal Gadot. People say it wrong all the time. Gal Gadot is in Heart of Stone on Netflix. And would you believe me if I told you her character's name is Rachel Stone? And the craziest part of that is the heart also means something in the movie. It's a wild title. Double meanings all over the place. My name is Brett Arnold. I'm the film critic of this podcast. And Mark Dusick is the film critic of this podcast and of MarkReviewsMovies.com, where he's been reviewing movies for 20 years, 20 plus years, 22 years, something like that. And you can
I'm so tired.
You know what? This week is a perfect example of why Mark is tired, because we're covering 10, and I thought that was a ridiculous amount of movies. If you go to MarkReviewsMovies.com, you gotta change your browser size to fit all the movies on there, because there are so many, or you gotta keep scrolling, because there are 14 movies on MarkReviewsMovies.com today. I cannot believe it. I'm looking at the movies I skipped, and I'm gonna go ahead and say, I'm gonna pat myself on the back for skipping those movies this week. They do not look great. There was one documentary that I'm sure is good. The Bobby Wine, the People's President documentary. I'm sure that was good. But, you know, I prioritize feature films instead of docs. Sorry to the docs. But we did get one doc in this week because I was very interested in the subject matter of the Stephen King, King on Screen movie. But we were both disappointed with that one. So just so much to talk about. Anything else to say, Mark, before we get right into it?
No, let's get right into it. It's going to be busy. Here we go.
I love it. 10 movies starting now with The Last Voyage of the Demeter, a Dracula picture. That is not the full title. It is just The Last Voyage of the Demeter. But I have seen it in some places as Dracula, Last Voyage of the Demeter. I think that's how it's playing in some countries, maybe. But it is a Dracula film, to be sure. Here is a trailer.
Evil is on board. Powerful evil.
We call him Dracula.
The Demeter, on charter from Romania to London. Shipping private crates. Contents unknown. Out at sea with no land in sight.
This here's Clemens. He's a doctor.
You dress like a learned man. University of Cambridge. I know my way around the boat.
Our charter has agreed to pay a bonus for timely arrival in London.
Let me show you the ship. This here is Huckleberry. We don't come with like this to give the yours clear.
Demeter's a fine boat, no doubt.
Thank you.
Mark, please explain what the premise of The Last Voyage of the Demeter is, because it's very familiar, but also maybe a new take, unless you've seen the BBC Netflix series Dracula from a couple years ago, which did an entire episode that was also The Last Voyage of the Demeter. But please, tell me.
Yeah. So it is based on a single chapter from Bram Stoker's Dracula. I kind of looked over it afterwards, and it's not even a full chapter. It's like 2/3 of the chapter is devoted to the captain's log. It's interesting. Yeah. But I'm no pun intended, all on board, even though I say no pun intended and then say the pun anyway. I was all on board with this idea. I still think it's a really, really novel take on Dracula. And it's crazy that the book is over 125 years old and people are still coming up with new ways to tackle Dracula, the character, Dracula, the novel, the idea of vampires, specifically in relationship to Bram Stoker's creation. I'm very happy that people are able to do this. I'm so happy that I really hope somebody remakes this thing in a few years with the same idea, the same concept, and maybe does something a little bit different with it, because it is just, you know, typical sort of vampire story that just happens to be set on a ship in the middle of the ocean and in the middle of the sea. And I'm kind of disappointed with that because it's such a great setting. The creation of Dracula looks so good in this movie. There's so much going on. There are like a couple of scenes of the characters where they actually have some debates about evil and what evil's presence in the world is and all this stuff that, like, this is what I want. I want the characters to exist and so that you feel that sense of doom, because the whole premise is set up that the ship arrives in England off the shore and everyone's gone and the thing is in disrepair. It's obvious something terrible happened. So you know what the ending of this is going to be, even if you haven't read Dracula.
Yeah.
Or seen any movie of Dracula.
Yeah, I always think those are bold choices that maybe don't pay off when you do like a in media res opening. Like, it kind of is a tension killer for me, or it can be. But I guess this is such an iconic story that it was fine to get everybody on that same page. That's not a problem I have with this movie.
No, I don't either. I don't have a problem with setting all of it up. I do have a little bit of a problem with the fact that it starts up with some opening text telling you exactly what happens.
Well, and the issue with that is the redundancy of the next scene, right?
The next scene is all the police constables in this small town showing up at the ship as they're like, oh, everyone's dead. Oh, here's the captain's log. I guess everybody died. Let's find out what happened.
I wrote that down because it was so bizarre. The movie goes, this movie is based off the captain's logs from Dracula. And the ship crashed here. And then the next scene does that exact same thing, but shows it to you. So it's just immediately jarring. And like, this doesn't seem like it needed to have both of those.
It doesn't. What it signaled to me is that the movie, for some reason, either from the filmmakers or from the studio, it doesn't trust the audience to just take it as it is. Just to say, like, this is what's going on. You have a ship that has crashed on this shoreline, and this is what happens. You need it literally spelt out at the beginning that this is what it is, and it's also based on Dracula, so get ready for all of that stuff too, because it takes a while. It takes a while for the vampire to show up, which is
about an hour before he kills a person, I think.
And I'm fine with that because I was still invested in the entire idea of it, and I liked some of the characters. Broadly speaking, I really did wish that they had focused a bit more on them and stuff that goes beyond just the vampire stuff going on. But it falls into this pattern eventually where it's just during the day, they're all arguing about what happened the night before. And then during the night, it's somebody wandering around the ship and looking around. And then Dracula pops out as a jump scare. And it's like, okay,
you're right. Yep. A pattern is like a nice way to say it. The way I said it is, it's the most repetitive, boring shit. I just couldn't imagine how you make a movie that's like Dracula on a boat, and everybody on Twitter has already made it into a hilarious meme of Dracula boat, and there's a million funny things. And I just, like, maybe that's why I went into this movie expecting some fun. But, like, I just think, sue me for thinking the Dracula picks off dudes on a boat movie should be fun. And it just tries to be very serious, which I would be for if it pulled it off, but I don't think it does. It's weirdly nasty and dour in all the wrong ways, like not in like gory horror ways, in like this is bleak and mournful sort of way. And my main takeaway, Mark, was like, on paper, this sounds great, and this might have worked at 80 minutes, but the movie is 2 hours long, and it's not like there's any story that's being spun in that 2 hours. It is as repetitive as we're talking about it being, and it's just so, I couldn't believe what I was watching. I was bored out of my mind, and I think you liked it a little more than me, but do you at least understand that perspective?
No, I do entirely. I do entirely. I think the tone of it is right for what it starts off being when it is just, you're right, like about that first hour of characters just talking about
stuff. And like
stuff
the production design is nice. It looks good.
Yes, it is. It does. Well, it looks shot. Very good.
Yeah.
I think the effects are fine when you come to Dracula. Yeah. I mean, he's in shadow a lot. I really, really like the evolution of Dracula, where he starts off like this wretched thing on the ground crawling towards his first victim. And by the end, you know, he's full power Dracula. I really like that idea.
That reveal, that first reveal of him under the stairs, like creeping towards that guy.
Yeah.
I was like, that was the first time I got excited in this movie. And I was like, is this going to be good? This is awesome. And then even the rest of the way that scene play out, it didn't really deliver for me. I'm just like, because it's like boring CGI digital jumping around. And like Dracula, to me, the thing that makes Dracula a cool character is like his personality and stuff. So like this movie kind of makes him a generic monster more so than Dracula, which is a problem also, I think.
Which I'm okay with, because I think in this situation, I believe the implication is that he is sort of like in feral form, because he doesn't need to put on this disguise of being human and blending in.
Totally.
So I get it. I get it. And that's why I did appreciate the fact that there is something to this character, that there is this, like, he looks like a pathetic wretch at the beginning and then transforms over the course of the movie as it gets more blood.
And I like the creature design too. I want to say, I thought it looked good. Yeah,
it does. It looks very good. But for that dour tone, I think is correct for that first hour where you're like, if we actually were invested in these characters and they start getting picked off one by one and nobody knows what's happening and you have this sense of dread and doom. Yeah, it makes sense to take it seriously. But once it does become just monster movie, people on the deck of the ship getting picked off, and that's what the focus is. You're right. A shorter, less serious tone feels more appropriate for it than in those sections.
Exactly.
And that is what takes over by the end. So yeah, it is sort of two minds about how to approach this material.
And I think
that doesn't quite work.
I think the people that like it, like Stephen King tweeted about liking it, and actually it ended up being a paid ad on Twitter. So I'm not sure if that got boosted by the filmmakers after they saw it, or if it was a planned ad. Probably that. I'm assuming that. But he said it's like a Hammer horror film and compared it to that. And I think that's a pretty fair comparison. But I just don't think it pulls off being that type of movie for the reasons we're talking about. Because it just decides it wants to do that and then also be the like action, more action focused, picking off dudes with, you know, winged Dracula flying around. And I would be fine with either one of those modes if either one of them worked. But like the picking off people stuff, is there an ounce of tension or suspense to any of the picking off sequences? No. There's nothing. They're all so flat and formulaic. And I feel like they all rely on, it's repetitive in so many ways. Like every scene feels like they're like knocking on the wood of the boat to hear things. It just is so repetitive. It feels like we watched the version that like has all the deleted scenes kept in it. And they really didn't like this could very easily have been trimmed down to a point where I was way more forgiving of it. But as is, I just don't understand what I'm looking at. It is so boring. It's literally like we all had the thought before you even saw it. I think like you're turning like a chapter or like a gimmick of the book, like a little captain's log gimmick. You know, a lot of books have gimmicks like that where like the doctor's notes are interspersed or whatever, like adapting just that. Like you need to have, I expected if they're going to do it in 2 hours, they would have some meat on the bone or something, but they don't. There's just nothing going on. I guess that's not fair because it tries to be about race and it tries to be about serious things. And I just think when it tries to do that stuff, it's just boring. I don't know. It sounds rude to say or something, but I really like Andre Overdahl's, I want to say debut horror movie. It's called The Autopsy of Jane Doe. I think it's awesome. And I think everyone should see that. And I have not liked a single thing he's done since then. And this is another one where I'm just like, I don't think this dude's got it. this movie did nothing for me. And by the end, I was like actively annoyed by it. Like I was passively annoyed by it. And then by the end, when they set up what they think they're setting up, I was just like fully like, fuck off. I don't care. Yeah, I'm definitely a solid 2 stars on The Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Slightly more generous, 2.5. And it, even to me, it feels generous. And that is just because I think the idea of it is so strong.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate, I think by the end, when it does kind of become more action and they're coming up with a plan and everything, it does feel like it takes on this sort of mythic level that you would expect from this specific material. Like, it's not just people fighting a demon. They're fighting off the concept of doom coming at them. Like, yes. we're helpless here, but you know what? We're going to stand up and fight. I did appreciate that section of the movie a lot more. I do think it picks up a lot of steam by the end. I don't know if it's setting up a sequel. This is just a weird little tag. I mean, I don't want to give away too much. I think maybe we're so accustomed to movies setting up sequels. I don't know if it actually is. I'm probably going to, in a couple of years, if they do, I will regret saying that.
Well, but they're obviously not going to. I don't know if you saw the box office numbers that just
I mean, I'm assuming.
750K. It didn't even crack a million on Thursday night. It's really
a tough
bad.
Sell.
It's a tough sell. Well, I think people on Twitter are right where they're like, in the vein of Plane, if you had sold this as Dracula Boat, and like that was the title,
something
and
like
it was a little sillier, it could have worked. But yeah, this dour version that I saw, a good friend of mine praised it. He really liked it and was like, it prioritizes story over theme. It's patient. I'm like, no, you're just describing a boring movie. Like, I think I'm glad you liked it, but I don't think this movie is patient. I think it is boring and repetitive. But yeah, the monster is cool. But even if I think they whiff on it being like, is this a good Dracula movie? Like, no way. No way. There's a million good Dracula movies. Bram Stoker's, which is the Coppola. What else is there? Dracula 2000 is interesting for dumb reasons. I never saw Dracula Untold. I'm sure that one sucks.
Oh, that's but, yeah, that's
yeah. There's a lot of bad ones, a lot of good ones, and this one, yeah, it's a bad, another bad one. But it doesn't. As I'm just trying to make the point that it doesn't feel like Dracula because it's just like a generic monster, even though they say Dracula a million times. Yeah, very disappointing. I really thought I loved Andre Overdahl. I just love The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is very good. Emile Hirsch, Brian Cox. It's probably streaming on Hulu, I think, is where I last checked it was. So check that out if you haven't seen it. That's one positive of Voyage of the Demeter coming out, is I get to recommend The Autopsy of Jane Doe to people, and maybe someone hasn't seen it. And that's cool. Now they get to watch it, hopefully. All right, let's talk about the Netflix Heart of Stone, starring Gal Gadot as Rachel Stone.
You know what you signed up for. No friends. No relationships. What we do is too important. When governments fail, the only thing left is the charter.
The most highly trained agents.
It's a bigger operation.
No political leanings.
What's with all the speculation?
No national allegiances.
Time to make a statement.
Working together to keep peace in a turbulent world.
Time to free my mind of limitation.
How many in the welcome party?
6 of them.
Vanessa the Majors, that's my form of reparations. They said you can't slide, you're a treasure to the nation.
Party seems fair.
This movie answers the question, is there any appeal to a Mission Impossible movie if there wasn't, you know, Tom Cruise doing stunts, if that wasn't a key element to it? What if it was Gal Gadot and a green screen? Would that also work for you? And I think the movie proves that it doesn't really work. I think it's passable. It's watchable. It's better than a lot of Netflix crap I see. It's a little slicker than Netflix crap that I see. But it ultimately still is just like a pale imitation of a Mission Impossible movie, right?
It doesn't help that one of the key plot devices in this is exactly the same thing as the most recent Mission Impossible movie that just came out, what, like a month ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's unfortunate timing, isn't it? Because, yeah, it is about this like super intelligent AI that can basically predict the future because it's gathering so much information and making so many calculations. the one thing I think is a little bit interesting here is the opening action sequence, which plays on expectations in a couple of ways, where you think Gal Gadot, who we know as an action star primarily from Wonder Woman and everything, is like a computer nerd sitting in the truck, and you're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. This is going to be interesting to see what they do with this character. And then they subvert the subversion, and it turns out, oh, no, she actually is a super spy. She's exactly what you think her character would be.
Yeah, I thought that was fun, but I also walked away going, this movie's going to confuse a lot of people. Like, it's like it's very convoluted the way it goes about setting up the team and the characters and stuff. But like, I was following it, but I was like, I already found Letterboxd reviews where people are like, incomprehensible. I did not understand.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I thought it was pretty clear, but I don't know.
I got it, but like, it is, I think that subversion, you're right. It is a subversion to the point where general audiences, I don't know, some people may miss something. Yeah.
I hadn't seen the trailer, and I'm wondering if, because the trailer kind of gives away the fact that she is supposed to be like a super spy. And if you're like watching at the start, like thinking the team that she's with is the team of super spies.
Yes.
Why is she like this?
I think that's part of the problem. Yeah.
That could be part of it.
I hadn't seen the trailer, so I was very like, I was totally on board with what was going on. Okay, I thought it was fun at first too. I was interested.
Yeah. What that opening sequence where she has like the augmented reality contact lenses and she can see the path that she's supposed
to
be taking.
It's so video gamey. Yeah.
It's so silly. And I thought, okay, I'm on board with this because you're like, oh, how does it all adjust in real time? Like if she goes down this path instead, if she decides to steal a snowmobile, what is the AI going to tell her to do? Right. All that stuff I thought was kind of funny. The whole like disposing of the bodies so MI6 doesn't notice that she's a super spy. I thought this is all kind of ridiculous and silly and a little bit creative. But definitely not enough. As it keeps going, it just keeps repeating all these ideas that we've seen in all these other movies. Like,
yeah,
there's I think the best action sequence, other than the first one, is the whole thing on the blimp where the heart, the AI is contained.
Yes.
And first of all, wouldn't the super intelligent AI realize the most famous dirigible accident in history?
Yes.
And it still repeats, like, this thing's filled with hydrogen. Like,
yeah, this will be fine.
You remember?
I am the most advanced form of intelligence in the universe.
Anyway, but the whole thing, her falling towards the desert, falling debris by her and trying to get a parachute. I know I've seen that action scene in another movie.
Yeah,
I know
it all feels like that.
But I'm still on board with it just because, like, it's still kind of cool. And there's a lot of things that are kind of cool in this movie, but the whole thing feels so just rote. It's everything that we've already seen in something else, and something else has done it better.
Yeah,
and
it's a classic Netflix movie.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly all it is. It's an inoffensive, generic spy thriller. It has
equivalent
a couple of twists,
to picking up a trashy airport novel at the airport.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. There's a secret villain reveal I didn't know was coming. I didn't see coming. And the way that it's staged is so quick.
Oh, it's
fast.
Like
it happens.
Up. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so sudden and so unexpected. I was like, oh, okay. I'm kind of on board with this.
I'll give you that.
That's all. Just a bunch of little tiny ideas, a bunch of little tiny scenes, little moments. And I'm like, okay, I'm down
I'm
with
shocked
it.
You ended up at 2 stars for this somehow. It feels more like a 2.5. That's where I'm at.
No. Oh, really? Okay.
Well,
no,
I don't know.
I'm not
the more we talk about it, the more I'm like, yeah, you're right. There's some stuff in there that worked. But ultimately, it's just the most, again, Netflix movie watered down version of thing you've seen that's not as good. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some stuff that works. The whole overall project doesn't work. That's the big problem with it.
Yeah. And the irony of Netflix making all these movies and shows about AI when they're the ones who are using the shit really also annoys me. But, yeah, so 2 stars because it's mostly because of the genericness of it all, and and the fact that you've seen everything it's done.
Yeah, pretty much somewhere. I can't remember where all the time, but I know I've seen that. I mean, obviously the big thing is the AI being controlled with the hands like that. That's Minority Report, straight out of Minority Report. Yep. I mean, there's just so much. I mean, I that's it.
I mean, yeah, the way the team names have like their the nines and the hearts and the jack of hearts, like Everything about,
are they saying there's only 52 people in this agency?
Yeah, there's always a rotating 52, plus a couple jokers. I don't know if they count in the deck. I always forget. I guess they do.
The jokers don't come up till the end, and that has nothing to do with it, I think.
Yeah, so it's all very silly. Yeah, I guess I'll be generous and give it the 2.5 to your 2. Just because I was like, it had some fun sequences in it, but yeah, it ultimately, you know, I'm never going to watch this again. I'm never going to watch Voyage of the Demeter again. That's a fun scale to always say. Will you revisit this movie? Definitely not. 2.5. Let's
move
on.
Will you see a sequel and hope it's better? Maybe?
Yeah, possibly. If I'm still doing this podcast. Yes. If I am not still doing this podcast, probably not. that's where that lands. Let's move on to the portion of the show where I don't think anybody will know any of these movies except for Gran Turismo at the end. This next one is called Between Two Worlds, and it stars Juliette Binoche. And I thought it was great. Here's the trailer.
Vous m'expliquez ce que vous faites ici, Madame Vinclair, quand vous courez après les heures de ménage? J'ai lu votre dernier livre. J'en ai marre d'entendre parler de la crise, du chômage, de la précarité, d'une façon abstraite. J'ai besoin de voir, de partager le quotidien, pour voir ce qui se passe vraiment.
Ah, c'est vous la remplaçante? Faudra vous fouler plus que l'autre, hein.
Ferry, c'est opération commando. Escale de 1h30, pas une seconde de plus. Pays au swing. Faut aller très vite, c'est très dur. On y va parce que le bus nous attend, le ferry lui n'attend pas.
Tu gagnes l'auto, tu fais quoi?
Je m'achète ma paire de baskets à 300 balles et mon tatouage.
Nettoyage! Allez, on se dépêche, ça pluie!
Tu vas pas passer ta vie sur le ferry.
Non, mais j'espère. J'espère aussi partir loin. Hein.
Pourquoi tu passes par là si pas la route?
J'ai pas le temps d'aller regarder la mer.
Ben, on le prend, là, le temps.
This movie was a lot thornier than I expected about the subject at hand. And I think that's exactly why it works. Tell me about this movie, Mark.
Yeah, so this is an adaptation of a nonfiction book by Florence Aubenas, who's a French journalist. She went undercover for about 6 months, pretending to be a temp worker, just taking all these odd jobs that would come up, a lot of cleaning jobs primarily. And she, you know, did them and talked to other workers, actual workers who are doing this in the shadow of the financial crisis of 2008. So that's what's going on here. And it's interesting because the movie actually addresses the big thing in the room here, the big elephant in the room here, which is like, so if this person doesn't need to do these jobs, why is she doing it? And what are the real world ramifications for actual people who do need these jobs to survive?
Yeah. Like, isn't she taking a job from somebody who needs it to do this?
Yeah.
And like,
exactly.
A much worse movie that is adapting that book would just adapt that book. And it wouldn't shun the woman who wrote it. But this movie is kind of like, isn't it kind of fucked up that she did this?
Yeah, a little bit. And I really appreciate the fact it did that, because it wasn't necessarily something I was thinking of, because it doesn't tell you right away. You just think that Juliette Binoche's character is just this, you know, recently divorced woman.
It's handled so well, yeah.
It is. And then you start to realize, like, it's revealed, we're not giving away too much, it's revealed slowly, but relatively soon, like, she starts taking notes on people, and you're like, why is she doing this? And
yeah, then, like, the first thing she says is, right, like, would it be, I would get in so much trouble if she saw these notes I was taking. You're like, what are you talking about? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, and why are you taking notes on this single mother of two or three, I think, doing all this? I didn't, and that's why. But yeah, the fact that the movie actually addresses it and kind of critiques the entire process of doing this, is really unexpected, and it adds this layer of depth, because you start focusing less on Binoche's character and you start focusing a lot more on everybody else surrounding her. And you start wondering, like, who are these people? Like, really, who are these people, and what are they doing, and what is going on in their lives? And the big focus is on Christelle. It's a character played by Helene Lambert, and she's so good in this. But she is that single mother of three who is trying to just keep her head above water and do things for her kids And you see all these ways that she's doing it. And I think that she becomes just as much of a focus as Binoche's character, because we don't really know Binoche's character at all, except that she is undercover and she's a writer and that's it. But we do learn a lot more about Christelle during the course of the movie. And so I appreciated that balance. The whole movie is this balancing act of trying to present the material from the book in a straightforward way so that you do realize it's like an expose of what it is like to do these temp jobs over and over and over again, to have no job security. But it also points out that, like, there is this distinction of the worlds of someone who doesn't need to do it and someone who
could take off the fucking smock from or apron or whatever it is from doing the horrible job and then go to your nice life. And then these people who literally can't and are doing it to make ends meet. And like, the movie does not provide any answers to these like tough moral quandaries that it's presenting, but it presents them and it leaves you to sit with them. And I particularly loved where it ended. I thought it was like,
me too,
pretty harsh, like on the part of like, fuck this lady on that space, because I think one of the last lines Crystal or whatever her name says is like, everybody in their place. And it's just a perfect summation of what's going on in this movie. You know, a movie that's asking tough questions about, you know, social structures in society and the difficulty of moving from one to the other. Or is it possible to even do that? And like, can you make friends with someone in a different social class than you? So I thought it was like really thought provoking and very cleverly handled, and just very impressed because I just can see the worst version of it in my head. And
it's
like such a thoughtful take on the material. It's like not quite as radical as, you know, Charlie Kaufman taking The Orchid Thief and turning it into adaptation or something. But it does feel like I bet the person who wrote the book's like, what the hell? What? You adapted my book and this is it? I bet the people who made it were like, we have Final Cut and you don't get to say anything, lady.
They changed the character's name too in the movie.
They probably had to. It's funny to think about, but like, that's cool. This movie feels like a radical act in that way.
But the other thing is, we don't know. I guess it's a French book. I haven't read it. And it was written like immediately after it all happened. So it was like in 2008, it was written and published and all that. And so we do have, you know, there is hindsight. This film obviously does have hindsight. It's unfair to say that the writer of the book hasn't had that same hindsight over the past 15 years or so. So, I mean, maybe she is on board with this take of it too. We don't know for sure.
Yeah, but we don't. I'm just projecting. It's just, this movie deserves credit for even bridging asking those questions, even if they don't have, you know, some people might say there's no answers in there. I'm like, yeah, because there's no answers. It's tough.
Yeah, there's no answers. We're still in the middle of all this.
Yeah,
stuff.
What do
it's
you mean?
Worse.
There are
it's
no
gotten
answers.
Worse.
Yeah. I'm 3.5 on Between Two Worlds.
Cool.
I thought it was great.
Very strong 3.
Love it.
Definitely worth checking out though.
Oh man, this next one. Let's just say it was a tough watch for someone whose wife is 8 months pregnant and there's a kid coming. It's a melodrama, so I'll let you put two and two together. I don't know what the trailer is going to tell you, but there's a shock in this movie that either hooks you or you're going to be repulsed. And I got to say, I was hooked. But I love a good melodrama. Here is Love Life, a Japanese film, I believe. Here you go.
Yep.
Trailer. I say that not super ignorantly. There's a Korean spoken in this film as well. It is multilingual. Here is Love Life.
お父さん認めてくれるかな今日
認めるも認めないもないよもう結婚しちゃったのか
でも次は本当の孫も抱かせてあそこでみんなと会ったよ知らない人いた
山崎です
ジローさん職場の話よくしてくれるけど山崎さんの話聞いたことない特別な人
相談者の方が聞こえない方で韓国の人みたいで
Walk me through this one, Mark. What is Love Life about?
It is about one thing at the start, which is this family. It's a married couple. And the wife is having some issues getting adjusted into her husband's family because her parents, his parents, don't necessarily approve of the marriage. There is like this whole sequence of celebrating the wife's son from a previous marriage. He won like this Othello tournament, so the board game.
Yeah.
And also a surprise birthday party for the father and the father-in-law, the older father. And that's what it seems to be. And it's just like telling you, like, here's the setup. There are all these different conflicts going on. The parents with the daughter-in-law. You have this woman at work. They both work in the same office. And this one woman is very, you know, distant from both of them for a reason that we start to learn. We also figure out the woman has an ex-husband that she might still have some attachment to. And a lot of that drama gets thrown out the window with this really, really shocking scene that I don't want to say.
Yeah, I won't either.
Because it is so jarring, and the way that it is shot and edited and put together adds like, to all of that.
It's like a horror movie, man. Like I can imagine seeing this in a theater, and everybody would go, oh! It would be insane. It would be crazy.
I did out loud at home alone. It's like, because it is all of it formally, it's all very patient. It's a lot of long takes and shots, you know,
and it seems like such a nice movie. I didn't know it was gonna do that to me.
Yeah, it's like the worst thing is like the mother being a little, you know, snippy behind the back. Like like saying, oh, you know, don't worry about it. My husband doesn't mean it, don't worry. But also, you know, could you give us a grandchild of our own for real? Right. Like, oh geez, yikes. Okay.
Yeah.
That seems to be the worst of it. And then that thing happens and it throws everything. Like you're completely out of the loop. And so it deals with the ramifications of all that while also dealing with the important things, like what would this bring up? It would bring up all of the conversations that they would have, like the distance that grows between the married couple and where they end up going and who they end up being attached to after all of that. And it deals with all of that. I don't want to give too much. It's so tough to talk about. It doesn't seem like something you would be able to give away anything. But
well, no,
there's
thing here. And I don't think if we did, it would mean anything really that much. Because this is a movie about characters and like the complex family dynamics and character dynamics that reveal themselves naturally throughout this movie. It's just so impressive. And it feels so like you get a feel for you. They tell you who these people are and all this stuff and their relationships, but the subtleties between them, you just get such a feel for this woman and like what she's going through. I just was really impressed with all the little details that grow to show all the pressures on this woman. I kept thinking throughout, they could have called this Past Lives, like another recent movie.
Yeah.
Yep. It kept reminding me that it could be called that and it would work great. It's hard to say what this movie is even about. It's just like, it's like a melodrama about the distance between people, I guess, and like what happens in the face of tragedy and, you know, love being like something that you have to work for. And I don't know, man, I just walked away from it devastated. Like it has a rare ending that made me cry and gave me goosebumps with like, you know, the final line or whatever it is that connects with something said earlier where the husband says to his wife, like, you know, how long have we been talking to each other without looking each other in the eye? And I just get all swept up in it. I realize I'm not doing a good job of selling it. I don't know how to describe it either.
It's a hard sell because it is just about relationships and it's about real people who are flawed and have issues going on beyond the obvious tragedy at the center of the movie. But like they are flawed people.
Yeah, it's a very human like movie. It felt very humanistic, like everyone could relate to this, unfortunately, because we all have these feelings. Sorry to be so vague about this movie, y'all, but I think it's worth seeking out. It's directed by Koji Fukada. It's a Japanese film, Love Life. Check it out. It's based on, I think, a song that plays at the end of the movie.
Yeah. It's based like on a pop song that was huge in Japan in the 90s, and it plays over the end. And I do like the double meaning of the title, which is, you know, like it's about the love lives of these characters, but it's also about how they come to love life in some way. I mean, it's an obvious double entendre, but it's still neat because you think it is about like these characters just, you know, ex-husband, ex-girlfriend come back in the picture. How does all that resolve? It's about their love lives, but how do you actually come to some sort of meaning and purpose in the face of tragedy?
That's what very it's complex. About. A very complex movie about family and yeah, individuality and oh god, I don't know. I love it. Three strong stars for Love Life, a movie we both had a very hard time describing to you.
Sorry about that. But very strong three
this
stars.
Next one will be much.
Definitely, definitely. Again, seek this one out. There's a lot of these foreign films that I think, you know, get limited releases. They end up on digital and they get overlooked, but these are worth checking out.
Yes. Let's check out this next one that will be very easy to describe. Aporia. Here's the trailer.
That blur is the prettiest thing I've ever seen.
You're selling your Saturn rocket? Your dad gave you that.
I don't want it anymore.
Sometimes I get so mad, I just want to strangle the man that did this to us.
There's a science to everything.
We can't save him.
Believe it or not, this was supposed to be a time machine. And now there's a gun that can fire a bullet into the past. All we need is a target.
You know that's impossible, right?
You forgot the soda again, didn't you?
Sophie.
I didn't know they were still making straight-to-video sequels to The Butterfly Effect. They're still coming out. That's a pretty mean comment for a movie that I mostly found fine. But by the end of it, Mark, I was definitely inundated with the idea that this is a movie doing a time travel plot, like an indie sci-fi movie, no budget, doing time travel stuff that's all about like the ethics and moral quandary at the center. And that sounds like it might be a unique take on the material, but for me, it's not. I've seen that a million times. I've seen Richard Kelly's The Box. I couldn't abide by the movie because it was so, it's like this low key indie version of something. And it just was a low key indie version of something I've seen before. And the low key indiness of it didn't add anything. It just kind of made it a little even more stale to me. Felt like a festival movie. What did you connect with here? Tell me what it's about also.
I liked it. It is about the moral and ethical questions that raise up with this whole premise, which is...
Isn't that what every fucking sci-fi time travel movie's about?
No, it's not always about that. How many Marvel movies are we watching with time travel and multiverse stuff that have nothing to do
but
with
those
any of that
those
stuff.
Aren't movies. Come on.
But this one is about, I think it's a novel idea for a time travel. Guys, a couple of scientists in their garage try to build a time machine, end up building this machine that can send an energy pulse to a specific place in time and, you know, potentially kill somebody because that's like, what, your second thought? What do you realize? Whoops, we screwed up.
Yeah.
How could we use this? Oh, we could use it to kill someone. I mean, that I thought that was believable because that's what technology always ends up going towards.
I thought that was a smart idea, too. The fact that you're trying to make one thing and you end up making another thing. That's how most things are invented.
Exactly.
And that was clever. And it's clever twists on time travel. Instead of going back in time, you're sending like basically a magic bullet back in time and it kills somebody at the exact point in time you want to. Yeah.
Yep. And so Judy Greer plays this woman. Her husband died in a car accident. There was a drunk driver. And she's like, okay, cool. Let's kill the guy who is going in the past is going to kill my husband so that my husband doesn't die because that guy doesn't deserve to live.
Yeah. She does her cursory research of driving to his house, seeing him drunk one time and going, this guy's a real piece of shit. I could kill him. No problem.
But she also, but she also knows that he killed her husband.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's a big thing.
Yeah, of course.
I know. I would love it.
I would do it.
Yeah, I love the definitive thing of her just pushing that button. Like, the friend is like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, yes. And she pushes the button to do it.
I'm like, it also reminds me of Pet Sematary. It just felt too familiar to me. Like, any, you know, raising the dead, there's going to be consequences. Like, yeah, it's a Twilight Zone episode. It's a Creepshow episode. It's a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Yes. But it is addressing those consequences. It is saying, like, okay, this person now doesn't exist anymore in this timeline. So what does that mean? It means that he left behind a wife and a child who might need help. Regardless of who he is, there are other people who are being affected. And then do you have
you
a
might
responsibility?
Say some sort of butterfly effect is occurring.
Yes, exactly. You keep saying that. It doesn't change anything about this movie, though. But so do you have a responsibility, if you did that, to help out these people because of that? And then how do you continue to help out those people? What's the best way to help out those people? Does it involve the time-traveling bullet again? It raises all these questions, and I enjoyed going through the whole process and watching it be about characters who are suffering through these things and trying to decide what the best course of action is. I appreciated the fact that it actually did deal with those ideas and those questions and trying to figure out how to tie that into this time travel thing. I liked it. I'm surprised you're so relatively cold on it.
Yeah, I think I'm so cold because I was also with it and just kept expecting it to do something new that I hadn't seen before. And it just didn't. It just kept doing, yeah, that's what would happen. You would see that and then you would go, oh, I want to help them now. And then you just try to help them. And then it spirals from there. And it's just like every dynamic was like the exact character dynamic I expected to happen. It just didn't surprise me. But like, if the bar is, you know, I don't know. I feel like if I was watching 10 movies a day at Sundance and I saw this, I would say it was good, you know, because it was better than the other things I saw. But on a regular day watching this movie, it didn't have enough juice to make it stand out from the plethora of movies that have explored this exact topic of either time travel or would you kill someone? And, you know, if you didn't know who they were, et cetera, whatever, like that's what the box is. The butterfly effect is the repercussions of time travel. There's the pet cemetery. Would you resurrect your loved one even if there were dire consequences? Like, it's all just stuff I've seen mined in better movies. But like, you know, I don't know. I was going to say as a showcase for an indie director, it's fine. But like it does, you know, it's very, I like the lo-fi-ness of the tech of the machine. It's effective for, I feel like I'm being mean to it because it's like a cheap indie movie. So I hear you, but it still ultimately just didn't work for me, but it's a 2.5-er. I'm not too mean.
Yeah, you're relatively cold on it, is what I said. It's a 3 stars for me. I enjoyed it. And I think if you're kind of fed up with, you know, multiverse stuff and time travel stuff that is just about like, how does the past change and all of that stuff? And
if you've never seen any of the movies I mentioned, it would be great, I think. But if that's my issue. Like, is it weird to say like the butterfly effect's a better movie? Like, I don't know if that's true, but it came first. So it feels better than this to me. Hilarious take that I'm having on this movie. I love it. Let's jump to the next one, which we'll agree on. Let's get back in the agreeing corner. Let's talk about a rare miss from A24. I think A24 has earned their rep as like the place that people see their name and go, I want to see that without even, you know, looking further than that. But every now and then they have one that they sneak out on VOD and they're like, yeah, check it out. It's on VOD at home. It's also in theaters, I think, but it's definitely on VOD. It's Medusa Deluxe. Stay away from this fucking movie. It's so bad. Here's the trailer.
You don't know what it's like losing your hair. You might as well be dead.
There could be a serial killer on the loose.
It's a hairdressing competition.
Did you kill him?
How did I even know it's murder?
Someone scalped him.
Was he all right?
All right? No. He was dead. They follow me, dead people. All I want to do is cut hair.
All right. That trailer doesn't really get at what it's doing, which is this movie is basically all one take gimmick thing. And I am begging gimmicky filmmakers obsessed with one takes to discover that editing and cutting are inherently cinematic, and watching people aimlessly walk around and talk in circles to keep up your fucking illusion of a long take is not. I thought this was maybe the most tedious movie I've reviewed on the podcast. I was tearing my face off waiting for it to end. What did you think? And what is it?
I wasn't a fan either. And the problem is, beyond the one take, which, yeah, is a terrible, terrible idea for this material specifically.
Yes.
It is supposedly a murder mystery, but it's clear that the movie doesn't care about the murder mystery at all. It turns out the murder mystery is entirely irrelevant by the end. It is more about the eccentric personalities at this hairdressing competition. I was kind of enjoying some of those scenes of just them talking and interacting. And there's they're more concerned about the fact that the competition might be rigged by like a hairdresser is like paying off somebody. The characters care more about that than they do the fact that one of their own might have been murdered. Yeah, I'm like, why are you throwing in this whole gimmick of there's a murder mystery and there could be a killer among them. We need to solve this when it doesn't even care about that. It cares more about the characters. Just make it about the characters. Make it about the high stakes of this competition.
Yeah.
That's much more interesting than a murder mystery whodunit that nobody cares about even inside the movie.
You get nothing about anybody because there's so many characters. So you're just like, why the fuck should I care about any of this? I don't know any of these people.
Yeah. And then on top of it, because of the gimmick, you end up following characters while other stuff is going on, presumably, and you'd be like much more interested to know what's this hairdresser up to while the manager of the competition is going down an elevator, walking across the parking lot, walking across the street, showing up at a car, talking
Use
to somebody.
Fucking cut.
And
Edit.
Then, hang on a second. I'm not done. Talking with this guy, turning around and doing the whole return trip across the street, across the parking lot, up the elevator and into the room. There's so much else that's going on in this story while all that is happening. Why are you wasting time letting us watch a guy walk just so you could show off the fact, hey, look, I got the camera on a crane to go up to a window after this point. Like, I don't care about that. I don't care about the staging of this when this movie is supposed to be about characters or a plot that you have set up very firmly. And instead, you're wasting all this time so that this illusion of a one take can be maintained. It's terrible, terrible idea.
It is the most exhausting movie I have ever seen. Maybe even talking about it is making me mad. There's nothing, like, as I said, it's trying to be a whodunit, but there's too many characters who you don't know or care about. They're having boring conversations that don't mean anything. And the camera's following them when there's much more interesting things presumably happening elsewhere. Yeah, it is just a total miss. I could see like people seeing this at a festival and like pretending it's good and thinking it's good because it's like artful one take. Look at the pretty pictures. It is just garbage. It is garbage. I hated this movie. 1 star for Medusa Deluxe. Sorry, A24.
Yeah, 1.5 because I did appreciate some of the performances here and I liked getting to know some of the characters. To the extent that we do get to know them, I did appreciate that. So slightly more generous 1.5.
Very nice. You're a very nice man.
Yeah.
Let's agree again with Jules, a movie that I'm surprised I liked as much as I did because it's very strange. Here is Jules.
I think that we ought to change our town slogan. A great place to call home is confusing. I suggest a great place to refer to as home. We need a crosswalk on Trent Avenue between Frost and Allegheny. And also... Oh, my. A UFO has crashed in my backyard, has taken out my azaleas, and destroyed my bird bath.
When you talk like that, it makes them all take us less seriously.
Did you just say UFO?
What is that?
You remember the spaceship? This is the little man who came out.
They just ruined the best moment in the movie.
I'm glad they ruined it because that delivery of that line is so perfect.
Yes, they ruined it. I mean by ruining it, I mean that is the funniest part of the movie, but they cut it so you don't see the funny part. So when you watch the movie, you will see the funny part. And her reaction made me laugh out loud. This movie, I will quote my friend Jesse Hassinger, who I host The New Flesh with. He wrote on Letterboxd, I was not prepared for how not terrible this movie is. Because I thought it looked, I think a lot of people are making fun of it because of the goofy way the alien looks or whatever. But this movie is so sweet and charming and really sad and bleak, but like, I felt like very real about like an issue no one talks about. It's a movie about aging. It's a movie about seniors. It's a movie about being old. It's a movie about the loneliness of these people at that age and how nobody pays attention to them or believes what they say or cares what they have to say. And it was a really great movie that once you realize what it's doing and that's what it's doing, I found it to be very sweet. What do you think?
Yeah, I am completely on board. It is all about those things. And it is also weird. And it embraces just how delightfully weird it can get, because you have this alien and you have people not believing him. And this alien is just sitting there watching TV with Ben Kingsley's character.
Yeah.
I believe the big plot thing is probably a reference to Alf. I'll just throw that out there. I don't want to give away exactly what the alien needs to fix the ship. I'll just say that.
Sure.
It's so funny. But yeah, at the heart of it is this sense of loneliness and of people just being ignored by society, whether it's something as silly as, like, I think the town slogan needs to change, or as serious as that crosswalk is very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
And I like the fact they established the fact that that crosswalk needs to be there because, like, nobody's listening to them and there is an actual issue. And so when the alien comes down, like, if everybody had just maybe listened to him, as ridiculous as it sounds, maybe checked up on the guy, like, are you really okay?
Yeah.
All of it could have been figured out. But because of that, because nobody cares about what he has to say, all of this gets to go on. And yeah, it gets at that, the way that we treat older people, the way that society just casts them aside and says, yeah, there's nothing really going on here. It does get at those deeper issues while being a very funny and very weird movie. And I appreciated the fact that it is that weird.
And I was impressed because I feel like we watch so many movies with actors that are, you know, older, senior citizens, let's say, actors. And they're, you know, the movies they do are so shitty and the characters they play are so one note senior citizen dynamic shit. And these people do not feel like one note caricatures. And they are real people with real lives. And you really feel that. And yeah, I was not, as Jesse said, I was not prepared for how much this movie worked for me, despite the fact that the alien looks like Paul from Paul and Powder from Powder combined. It's a weird looking alien. Very delightful, good performances from Ben Kingsley and Harriet Sansom Harris, who's great in that one scene in Licorice Pizza, and she's in Phantom Thread. She's a PTA lady. Jane Curtin is great. Zoe Winters from Succession is in this as his daughter. Very, very surprised that I enjoyed this. But I think it doesn't sound fun. A movie about how seniors are lonely doesn't sound fun. But the movie makes that fun, which is why I think it works, right?
Yeah, it makes it fun. It makes it a little bit sad, just sad enough that you're going to be like, oh, I should probably call some people that I might know in my life. And also tell them to go see this movie because they'll relate to it. But I think everybody can relate to this. It is just about, you know, this very strange situation and these very real people. I really like Kingsley's performance, but I think Sansom Harris's performance is just so good. There's so much going on with her character as it comes out, like that she has a daughter, and the daughter, she tries to be as supportive as she can be to the daughter, and the daughter just ignores her because, you know, just says like, oh, you know, she doesn't need to focus on that because her mother supports her. And it's such a sad, sad situation.
Yeah.
And then what ends up happening when we realize how the alien has all those powers, that scene also is very, very funny and also scary and sad too. There's just so much going on here. It has this great balance of tone. That's a hard thing to pull off when you want to do something as out of this world as alien visits an old man and shenanigans ensue. And also, isn't it awful how we treat senior citizens in the world?
Yeah.
And it strikes that balance really, really well.
I can't wait for people to see that scene. That's so funny. I'm thinking, I want to scream it, but I won't. All right. So I'm 3 stars on Jules.
Yes, I am right there with you.
All right. Now let's continue our agreeing with the pod generation.
I've been having the strangest dreams.
Rachel, dreams are not reliable analytical material. That's so 20th century.
Hi, Rachel. We're delighted to let you know that we've had movement on our wait list.
We got a spot at the Womb Center.
Oh, my God.
But I haven't told Elvie yet.
Oh, why, Rachel?
He wants a natural child.
But hold on. You put us on a wait list to have a baby and an egg.
No, it's not an egg.
It's an egg.
Women are reluctant to have children because it's not made convenient. We want them to pursue their careers and dreams.
We can't live in the past.
I want to have a child with you.
Let's do it, Rachel.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sure you're all very excited.
I saw this in January at Sundance, and it was one of the bad ones where I was like, this made no impression. This is a typical Sundance Festival movie with like an interesting premise, but it has no idea what to do with it or see it through. It just kind of repeats itself throughout. I think it was David Sims, a film critic at The Atlantic, who said it would be bad to just state a baby in a plastic egg that you control with an app. Okay. Thank you for telling me that. Like, that is the reaction I had to this movie as well. Like, what am I... Okay, I guess this movie's supposed to be about AI and tech run amok, but it doesn't really have a lot to say. Do you agree with what I'm saying?
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it doesn't... I mean, it doesn't have much to say. And a big problem with it is the world doesn't make any sense. And somehow, yeah. A world, up to maybe 60 years in the future already feels dated now. Seeing this thing, like... The phones look exactly like they do now. I'm trying to think. The cultural references, they talk about Bitcoin and NFTs in this right now, yes. In 60 years in the future. Like, there's just something weird about like a movie attacking the future, a possible future, by telling us where we're at now with specific references, with specific touchstones to the world we're living in now. It's like, there's so much else that would be going on in this world of the future that I don't think anyone would even remember NFTs or anything like that. And then the entire thing about nature, I find the movie's vision of the future right now to be optimistic, where apparently everybody hates nature. The city has built up where there's like little tiny natural pods that just have some plants in them. And are we to assume then that like just... You know, we don't care about trees at all, that there are no, you know, climate disasters going on, that somehow we solved all of that and yet also don't care about it. None of it made any sense. But the big thing is just the story is just, yeah, it's just couple decides to have a baby by way of this pod. So the fetus is in the pod and they're just watching it grow and realizing like, oh, I guess maybe I could be a parent. Maybe I'm having some trouble being a parent. I don't know. It's so busy throwing all these other things in, though, that I didn't have any focus. There's the whole AI psychiatrist. There's the whole workplace environment. There's this whole thing going on with work of like keeping track of how much she's working and saying like, you've been less productive today. Is something going on? The entire world is privatized, which I think is one of those like, yeah, that's probably going to be accurate at some point in the future, but it doesn't address it in any way except saying like this Jeff Bezos lookalike controls the entire country, apparently. Like, okay, let's explore that idea. If you're going to bring it up, let's explore it in some way. But instead, it's just, I don't even know what the movie's trying to do. It's very confused and it's very confusing, and I don't. Yeah, it's hard to react to it. I guess Clark and Ejiofor are pretty good here, but their characters are so tied to the world and the plotting that there's really nothing to them. It's just so empty and shallow. I don't know what to say much about it. And I think because you saw it in January, I don't know how much you have to say about it either.
Yep, I think we can leave it at that. I think we'll just leave it at we'll leave it at what you said because you nailed it. It's supposed to be some satire about, you know, our dependent on technology and how even like childbirth could become affected by that and blah, blah, blah. It just wasn't amusing or fascinating. I didn't walk away going like, I felt like I learned something about society or humanity. It was a tired concept that didn't really work as a feature. I feel like I should give it 1.5 because I don't remember, but because I don't remember it, I'll give it 2. It'll be very nice.
Dang. Okay. I'm giving it 1.5. I'll take it.
Ooh, I don't think I knew that you did that. That's very spicy. I love it. I love it. I love when you don't like something. Let's talk about, perfect.
I don't like something.
I'm sure you don't.
I'm glad somebody does. That's good.
Yeah. Well, this next one, I guess I'll be happy and you won't, because you hated this one and so did I. And so did I, but I guess I enjoy your hate of it. Here's the trailer for King on Screen, a documentary about Stephen King movies.
It all started with Carrie. Seeing her burn everything down at the end, you're watching it, it's thrilling.
Creepshow had a massive impact.
It completely traumatized me.
Aren't you going to say hello?
Pet Sematary is a great movie.
Misery is one of my favorites.
Stephen King writes human beings, and then he puts them in phantasmagorical situations.
Instead of setting everything in big cities, he chooses locations that are identifiable for everybody.
It's an idealized America, but then it's ripped apart and sent to hell.
When I think of my favorite Stephen King movies, I think of Stand By Me and The Shawshank Redemption.
I remember being shocked that someone who I associated so much with horror was capable of creating something so beautiful.
Well, that's about the pace of the movie. It's just people saying how much they like some Stephen King stuff. Before we lay into it, because we should, it's not very good. There's some insight to be had in this, if only because the breadth of people they interviewed. They interviewed, I think, 27 most all white dudes, I think, who directed Stephen King movies. Like, they've talked to a lot of people. But like, by virtue of making your documentary and like what you include and what you don't include, it makes some things seem more important than others. So like, why are you spending so much time talking about the Stand TV show that nobody saw? And it's because they had the guy there. And like, they talk a lot about The Green Mile and The Mist and what's the third one? Shawshank
Redemption.
Yeah, because they got Frank Darabont. And Frank Darabont's the most interesting part of this. And I think if there's anything to be learned, it's in those moments where there's footage of Stephen King on set of The Green Mile. Like, that's fun. And like, I think Darabont reveals that Bruce Willis is the reason Michael Clark Duncan got cast in The Green Mile, because he just was reading the book and called Darabont, who seemed to not really know him. And he said, "Hey, Darabont, I'm reading Green Mile. You got to cast this guy." And it ended up working out. So like, there's moments in there where like, okay, that's interesting, and I didn't know that. But I think largely my review of this movie is I'm going to say I'm a casual King fan, because I know huge King fans and I haven't read nearly enough. But I think even the casual King fan will not learn anything from this movie. It is very pedestrian in its insights. So that one thing about Bruce Willis is the one thing I have for you, because that's the one thing I felt like I didn't know going in. But like, is that okay? Is this okay? Is there okay for there to be a movie that is for like the layman to get into King, maybe? Do you think it works on that level? Talk to me about it.
I would say it would be nice to have it be aimed at the layman and to get involved in this stuff, but I don't think it even does that well. Because you have, you know, the famous, I mean, for people who know King, you know, he talks about it in Dance Macabre, the scene of Stanley Kubrick calling him in the middle of the night to say, "Do you believe in God?"
Yes.
That anecdote is repeated twice, back to back, in this movie.
I know.
Two different directors tell the exact same story back to back. This thing is structured so terribly.
Yeah,
the rhythm of that trailer is the rhythm of this movie. It feels like the intro to a documentary that's like going to introduce you to the person, repeated over and over and over again about these different movies with no real sense of form. Sometimes it is chronologically based. Sometimes it's based within a certain filmmaker. The absences here are noticeable. You have the director of the Stand miniseries. They couldn't even get archival footage of Rob Reiner, who made Stand By Me and Misery.
Yeah.
They couldn't even get anything on from Rob Reiner. And so his absence here, when they talk about those two movies, because you have to talk about those two movies so much. Sometimes it's a connection thematically. Sometimes it's a connection just, hey, Kathy Bates was in Misery and she was also in Dolores Claiborne.
And like
that's the connection. It's all over the place.
The people who made this movie didn't even have the sense to go, maybe we shouldn't have the sequence where we say he's really great about writing women told by a bunch of fucking guys. They didn't even get a woman to do that. Like, it's just really poorly done. Like, that's all we can say about it. I particularly, do you remember the Silver Bullet part? Because it just mentions the name Silver Bullet and then starts talking about it in as if everyone who like would know every detail about it.
Yeah.
It's like, it was like they didn't give any like story details. They're just like, yeah, and in that part. It's like, what are you talking about? It just feels like an excited child made this who like wanted to show you all their favorite Stephen King moments. But yeah, it's very lacking. I'm going to go ahead and give it 2 stars. I did not care for it.
Oh, man. Another 1.5 for me. I was very, very disappointed and frustrated with this movie. Not only for the fact that, yeah, it's covering familiar ground if you're aware of King's work, but that it doesn't know what it's doing. And I liked Darabont's stories. Darabont is the star of this movie.
Yes.
And it's nice to see him talk about this stuff.
I love all three of those movies. I think The Mist is my favorite. Yeah, it's the most Mist, horror movie.
this is the one thing I will give it credit for. It does shine a light on some things. Like The Mist, I think, gets a little bit overlooked because it's made by Darabont, who did Green Mile and Shawshank Redemption. And I love the fact that they do focus a good amount on Dolores Claiborne, which I think is one of the great King adaptations.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give it some credit for actually looking past the obvious ones. But I mean, that feels like very minimal credit to give it. It's very, very poorly made.
Yeah, it's a bummer because we love the guy. Would have been an easy layup recommend if it was okay. But it's like one of those like this could have been a bonus feature on a DVD thing. And even then it would be bad. All right. That was 9 that are out today. And let's talk about a 10th that is in theaters this weekend and next, but it is not out. It is out on August 25th. Sony wants to be very clear. Here's a trailer for Gran Turismo.
Who do you think the best driver is?
Probably Rory.
I would dust him in a lap.
Jan, all you do is play video games with some crazy dreams of racing cars.
Dad, you're the one that told us always do something we love.
You know what racing cars cost? Look around.
It's not our world, son. What is this?
It's a contest. The best Gran Turismo players in the world get a chance to compete in professional racing.
Dude, this is real.
Mark, this is one of those corporate executive warship movies that we keep getting lately. And it's a generic underdog sports movie that really wants to work. That I see some people clapping in the audience. I'm like, really? Did that work for you? It wants to be that. It wants to be that. And it wants to be a 2+ hour commercial, not just commercial. I'm going to go ahead and call it propaganda for a video game. Because the ultimate message of this movie, Mark, is basically a defense of your child. It's like a child's minded defense of playing video games. It's like your mom tells you to stop playing video games, right? And you go, no, mom, like I'm training. I'm going to be a race car driver. It's going to work for me. This is a beneficial use of my time. And the movie says, that's true. You can play video games enough to where you would be one of the best racers in the world or whatever. And if you check the Wikipedia page for this man and this movie, you will see that there are some liberties taken. It is not quite flaming hot level of bullshit, but it's not quite how it's presented. But my main takeaway from this movie is watch it if you want to learn how to pronounce Nissan. I thought it was Nissan.
I've already forgot. I thought it was Nissan, too.
I thought it was Nissan my whole life. I'm pretty sure it's Nissan, the way they say it a million times. But if you want to learn how to pronounce Nissan and then forget it, watch this movie. But, like, I don't know. Besides the fundamental video game propaganda thing, the movie is supposed to be a underdog sports movie about a racer going from zero to hero. That's like all it's trying to do. And I found the racing sequences to be completely inept, unexciting, poorly put together and like rendered, like they had, you know, they did it for real and they tried to make it look like a video game, which is so bizarre. You go.
Yeah, that is the weirdest part of this, is that it almost feels like the video game sequences are more realistic than the racing sequences.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. Like, I understood the kid putting the car together to race online with this guy and going through the race. I understood that more and why that was important to him than I did, like, when he's actually in a race car on a racetrack with high stakes, with potentially deadly stakes. That didn't feel real. And that part should feel real. It should feel like the most real thing in the world. But the way that it is shot with these, you know, and edited, the editing is just like, hey, here's a highlight reel of this one lap. They pause it to let you know where he's at. It's like, it's so distracting. The whole formal element of it is like, this feels like you're just telling me what's happening in this race instead of showing me what it would be like to be behind the wheel of a car that's going hundreds of miles an hour down a road.
And like when we say the real life racing becomes like video game, it's because like it'll just like in Heart of Stone when they throw the line out where she's supposed to see where she should go. In Gran Turismo, they'll throw a line out on the track where he can see the line in his head where he's supposed to go to pass a guy. And that's like the only trick the movie has, and it thinks it's cool. And it
there's two other tricks.
Okay.
Sorry, there's two other tricks. So the other trick is there's an arrow with the place of the car above the car that he's in, so yeah, you know what place he's in. Yes. And also when it goes behind the windshield, you see a heads up display of how fast he's going occasionally. There are three tricks
that mean nothing when you're watching. Exactly. The movie. It's also, I almost want to say spoiler alert and go into something, because I think it's a very weird movie to have like the follow your dream aspect because of like the complications that happen in the movie and the way the movie handles them. Just going like, nah, don't worry about that thing that happened. It'll be fine. And like, I just found it to be so goofy the way it's presented, but it's just dumb. It's just a movie that is video. As we said, it's propaganda for this video game. And like, when you get down to it, the one thing I walked away going is like, that would be so stupid if this were actually a real thing. Like, it's so dumb to consider like, yeah, maybe the guys who were very good at the video game could do the complete different thing and race a car. It's just so dumb. And like, yes, it worked for a handful of people or whatever. Like, it's sort of true. But like, I don't like that this movie exists, because I feel we're going to get, you know, the Call of Duty movie about a gamer who follows his true story, his inspirational dream to get drafted and die overseas or something. Like, it feels like we're nearing that point.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the implication there. When you read up on the real Gran Turismo Academy, I think that's what it is. Like, yeah, you read up on it. Like, a lot of the real person is unique in that he never did get behind a racing, you know, behind the wheel of a racing car. But a lot of the other people who did, because there were people before this guy, this movie makes it seem as if he is the first one to ever do it. Technically he is, because he was the first one to ever do it without ever getting behind the wheel of a race car. But other people who have done this have been in a race car before and have raced, I guess, amateurish, on an amateur level. So there is some unique story to it.
Yeah.
But his story is very, very much not important to this movie, right? It's just,
yeah,
he plays video games, he goes through the academy, he becomes a racer, and that's it.
There's no characters
really to his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's okay. He's fine in it, but like, he's not super compelling. None of the side characters are compelling. I was bored out of my skull. Like, I feel like this and Demeter are a very boring two movies. Like, nothing of value happens in this. It just feels, you never escape the fact that you're watching a commercial. It never escapes that, hey, I'm watching a movie called Gran Turismo by Sony that's really hoping to sell me on the idea that Gran Turismo is cool and that it's maybe even good and like could lead to good things for people and have people follow their dreams.
Except for that one incident.
Oh, God. It's so jarring.
It is.
It
yeah,
just doesn't
it makes,
fit in this movie.
No, and especially
and like,
the way
I know it's
handled.
True. I know it's yeah. true, but does that
but
change?
But it really makes you question, like, is this a good idea?
Yes.
It's a terrible thing to throw in, even if it is real.
Yes.
And the way that it's handled is like, I was sitting there wondering, like, yeah, maybe this was a really terrible idea. And these people should pay some repercussions for it.
I think you're right. It just proves definitively that it was a dumb fucking idea. And they're just, they skim right past it and go, no, it's fine. This is actually good. And it happened to
me too.
It happened to me too. I also did that, by the way, your coach. And I let it ruin my life. So you shouldn't. Like, okay, this is weird messaging.
Yeah, just David Harbour is the coach. He's pretty good.
Yeah.
I like that he brings this level of weariness to the character, who is basically there to spout a bunch of cliches about you're not ready for this.
That's the whole thing.
Like, oh, I believe in you. It's good.
Just like montages of them getting better. Like, it's just predictable humdrum sports shit. And I don't know. It's like, I see people say it's like well-made, competently made. I'm like, no, it's not. The racing is some of the worst I've ever seen in a movie that's supposed to be about racing. And like, it's just funny because I also think if I hadn't seen Ford versus Ferrari, I would have no idea that there was like a 24-hour race that made, like, the idea of a 24-hour race is so ludicrous to me. And like, I feel like Ford versus Ferrari sets it up very well, so you understand it. This movie just throws you into it. It's like, yeah, there's a 24-hour race now that he has to do. And it's not all him. There's other people involved. And it's just like, it's just very poorly handled. And again, Ford versus Ferrari, very exciting racing sequences. Really great. Great sound design. Gran Turismo felt nothing the whole time. It just is, even like the spectacle that should like raise my blood pressure or whatever you want to say about a movie that is supposed to be exciting. Nothing happened. Flatline. Boring fucking movie.
The spectacle of it is weird too, because it does, again, that's the other element that feels like a video game, because there's like a crash and it plays out in slow motion. And like, yeah, that feels like something that would come out of a video game, and maybe not that specific video game. But again, why do you not feel that speed? Why do you not feel that tension of the cars being that close to each other? And how do you make that move? I wanted to feel that. I wanted to feel like, what would it be like for this kid who has never done this before to experience that? And the movie never gives you a sense of that at all. And that's like the worst part of it, I think, is that it doesn't feel real on a level of character, on a level of story, and just within the spectacle of it, that the part that you want to see, that racing, never feels real.
I'm kind of fascinated by the people who think it's good. I have a few a handful of critics in my life who like really enjoyed it. And I think it's because it's in the shape of an underdog sports movie that you're supposed to clap at. And I think some people just get caught up, even if it's not good enough and hitting it's just like a base thing where you're just like, oh, I'm supposed to clap because the underdog won here. And like, it just rubs me the wrong way that people are like, it's like a stupid thing to say, but like it's weird to see people like just blatant basically a commercial for a video game that people are like, no, it's good. It's a sports movie. I'm just like, it isn't. I mean, it's trying to, but no, there are just go watch a sports movie. Go watch a real one. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that maybe give it credit because it's not just, you know, an adaptation of a video game.
Yes.
That's it. It's not just trying to recreate the experience of the video game.
It's like that whole,
although it does,
Lightyear meme of like, it's not based on Toy Story. It's based on the true character of Buzz Lightyear. It's like one of those complex things. It's not based on a video game, but it is, but it's based on a true story. Don't worry.
Yeah. It's not really about the video game, except that all the racist scenes look like a video game, but don't worry about that. It's not really a commercial for the video game, except it clearly is, and it's also a commercial for Nissan.
Nissan.
Because Nissan, you could tell Orlando Bloom was coached. You have to say it exactly like this, because I think, and he's hardly in the movie, but I'm pretty sure he says Nissan a lot in the movie.
Oh, you can tell 400 times. Yeah,
yeah, he is getting ready every time he says it. Like, oh wait, okay.
This is a remarkable marketing opportunity for Nissan. That's my impression. I have no idea what that accent was or what his accent was. I don't know what he is in real life or what that character was, but that was my impression of it.
He's a marketing guy. It's one of the heroes of the movie is a marketing dude.
Well, that's what I mean when I say it's a corporate worship movie. I feel like that was undersold in the trailer or something. I feel like a lot of people, most people think it's a video game movie or whatever, but it's more, the most operative thing it is a corporate warship movie in the vein of what I can't even name them now. Air. 14 other ones that came out this year.
Yeah. The only difference is this takes place in the 2000s, not the 80s or the 90s. That's the only distinction.
But it's just another one of those things where it's
and it's also not good.
Yeah, isn't it great that a corporate guy thought of this dumb thing? It's just it's so stupid. Again,
and a bunch of other corporate guys said, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea."
I want to say that spoiler because it makes the whole thing so stupid.
I know, but I won't. It really does.
1.5.
And then that happened. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna go the 2 this time around. Yeah, 2
all right. Well, this was a fun one. Very, very varied in terms of what we covered. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube. Give us ratings and reviews. If you're on YouTube, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. Jump on over to Apple Podcasts. Write us a review, please. There's at least like 200 of you regularly watching on YouTube. I need your numbers. Throw them in the Apple Podcasts. That one's easy. You don't need to do anything besides have an account. On Spotify, you actually have to listen on there, and then you can rate us. So if you want to do that, I also would appreciate it. All right. This has been 90 minutes of 10 movies. Goodbye.
The show starts in 1...
Shut up. Ush.